Today's episode of Gluck Radio is proudly brought to you by Audible.com. Audible.com is the premier provider of digital audiobooks, offering titles in every genre. Now, I want you to go and get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/gluckradio. There are over 150,000 titles to choose from your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. If you're a fan of this show, you might like to download American Savage by my fellow podcaster and sex advice columnist, Dan Savage. Or how about Crush It? Why now is the time to cash in on your passion by Gary Vaynerchuk. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/gluckradio. Again, that's audibletrial.com/gluckradio. Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. While most of us think of women when we hear sex work or prostitution, there is a whole mostly hidden industry of men who do sex work too. Who patronizes them? What do they do? And how does homosexuality and masculinity factor in? How do American sex workers compare to those all over the world in an industry when less than 10% are actually gay? What effects does male sex work have on workers themselves, the clients who employ them, and society as a whole? From gigolos to HIV, we'll hear about it all from Australian academic Victor Minichiello, author of Male Sex Work and Society. In a country where a gay marriage is increasingly being accepted, can the same be said for male sex work? Race, power, and gender all converge in an industry that goes against every stereotype surrounding it. What's a real midnight cowboy like? Victor, welcome.
Great. It's nice to be on your program.
Victor, when we talk about male sex work, explain what we're actually talking about. Are we talking about homosexuals, heterosexuals? What is the scope of male sex work?
Okay, well, that's a very interesting question. When we're talking about male escorts, we're really talking about any male, could be gay, could be bisexual, could be straight identifying, providing sexual services to either another man, usually, but also increasingly to women for a price, for money.
Question, where do these women come from? They usually could go to a bar and get laid whenever they want to. And, I mean, they must be pretty ugly women.
Okay, well, well, let me provide some a context here. So that I could answer your question. The book is called Male Sex Work and Society, and some very basic propositions influence this work. First, we accept the fact that human beings are sexual beings and that the expression of their sexuality is core to their identity. So, and, you know, Freud, you would know this, and your listeners would know this. Freud observed this some time ago. Second, there are biological facts behind how sex occurs. But more importantly, there's also a social and cultural context of how we define, give meaning, express, and experience sexuality in societies. And the third context that's important here is that masculinity plays an important role that colors the sexual expression of men and the sexual interactions of men who have sex with men and between men and women. Now, sort of a long way to answer your question, with the changing notions around sexualities, are men becoming sellers of sex rather than simply buyers? That's the key question we're trying to address. And how does this get manifested in the new age of technology and gender politics?
I thought men were always the sellers of sex. That's what marriage was.
Well,
or no, well, no. Actually, they were the buyers of sex. You're right.
They were the buyers,
they
not
the
sellers.
They were the buyers of sex, yeah.
Yeah. So not, this was not always the case. Like, if you go in Roman times, it was, for example, if you go back and you look at this historically, there, you know, the documents and will show that male escorts have existed from ancient times to the present, and there's representation of male escorts in historical documents as well as in films, and more recent. In Greek culture, it was sexually permissive, especially of sex between males, and there was an articulated set of social sexual codes that delimited these relationships. And male prostitution was tolerated, was decriminalized, and all prostitutes, whether female or male, were taxed. And it was also legal and perfectly acceptable for males to have sex with each other in the 4th century of Rome. And in the Roman Empire, slaves and former slaves of both sexes were forced to engage in survival sex and often were sold to buyers. And there's some historical documents that show that the number of male prostitution was probably just as large as that females. Now, to get back to the question of women as the buyers, as women gain power and economic prosperity and, of course, independence, and as the male body is marketed as a commodity of pleasure by the media and the fashion industries, and not including the social media, women can produce or can purchase the sexual services of men if they so choose. And I'll read two quotes from women so that you get an insight of their motivation. And their motivation to purchase or to hire a male sex worker is no different to that of men. It's often freedom to employ them. They have the freedom and the means to employ one. It's a lifestyle choice. It's a fulfillment of personal and sexual needs. So here's the experience of one female client. And she says, for a few years now, I haven't had any time for relationships. Obviously, she's a professional woman, busy working. I'm a workaholic. I love my career and my job. And I don't really have or want a serious relationship from now with all the hassles and baggage that comes with it. I needed sex. I wanted sex and nothing more. No strings attached. But not that type of Saturday night sex when you could go out with your best girlfriends, get drunk, and come home with a random guy that you have just met a few hours before in a bar. I wanted someone good, someone great, someone that knows women in and out. I wanted to feel that it was all about me and about my pleasure. Another female client states, make no mistake, Anthony's very good at his job, and that job is about making a woman feel wonderful. Any chemistry experienced in those moments is genuine, but I don't think he would be doing his job well if he weren't left wanting more. He's extremely easy on the eye, and you feel comfortable with him immediately, but that all comes with a price tag. I think what we're seeing is a greater acceptance of this notion of sexualities in the plural, which means that their various options become more visible. They often challenge the heteromasculine view of sex. And but male escorts mostly provide services to males.
And this is meaning what you just stated in terms of the male escort providing services to women who are who are not the ones that cannot get a man, but simply don't A, want the complication, or B, they don't want the inferior man. You know, they want what they want. Now, that makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah.
How are we differentiating that from the male prostitute who is seeing other men? Tell me about these men. Are they married? Are they closeted homosexuals? Are they just experimenting? What's the figures and what's the reason for
okay.
that?
Okay, there's been a lot of research that started to look at that question, particularly in the United States. And there's a number of researchers from New York that are looking at that question. But so what do we know about male escorts, particularly those male escorts who provide services to other men? Firstly, what we know is that they're now using e-technology to broadcast their services. So these are men or male escorts who don't necessarily work on the streets. Most of them, you still have a street male escort population, but these are men who use...
Those are usually transgender, and usually the on the streets, aren't they normally transsexuals? Transgender.
No, they're often there are some. There's also youth, homeless people who work on the streets, because obviously to work on online requires resources. I'll say more about that, but I want to get back to your original question, which is who are these guys? A significant number do not identify as gay. We know that. On average, they're about 28 years old. They're ethnically diverse. In the United States, 54% are white, 22% are black, 14% Hispanics, 8% multiracial, and 1% are Asian.
And so, this is so important, because you said two things, and they are a little shocking. Not shocking, but question. If a man is having sex with another man, can he still be identified as heterosexual, straight?
There's this new term called gay for pay.
Gay for pay.
Gay for pay.
And what do you, and from your perspective, I mean, is gay for pay... I mean, you couldn't pay me enough to have sex with another man just because there'd be an aversion to it. Wouldn't the gay for pay still imply that there's something comfortable within you to be able to go ahead and have sex with another man?
Well, it goes back to my earlier comment about how society is becoming more accustomed to this notion of sexualities in the plural and looking at various options. The you know, that's a complex question in terms of, you know, because not any male could be a gay, could be an escort, and not any male could be a male escort that provides services to other men. So in the market, you notice that there are male escorts who will say that, you know, they're exclusively providing services to women, or they will say that they're exclusively providing services to other men who ask about their personal sexuality. They'll either identify as gay, or identify as bi, or identify as straight. I think it also reflects what's happening in larger society. I think people are becoming much more fluid about their sexual expressions. Of course, it gets more complicated in the sex industries, because they're doing it for payment. But, you know, we did this large study, profiled over 1,000 male escorts who advertised in the web. We did it once in 2005, and then we repeated that in 2010 to get a sense of not only who are the escorts, but who are the clients, because that's also a very, very important question. And in the 2005 study, we were able to capture 71% of the total escort sample at that time who used a website called rentboy.com. And we looked at the profiles of escorts over 14 cities, and New York City was included in there, and 31% of that sample came from New York. Now, so again, we found that, like other studies, the mean age was 28.5 years old. 12% reported body weight of 200 pounds or more. So these are highly muscular guys, you know, the hypermasculine body type. More than a third provided exclusively top services. I'll explain what that means in terms of a top service. A top service is a male escort who will receive oral sex and who will give penetrative sex. So you know, that's the interesting point there is the hyper-masculine body type. And of course, not all male escorts have the same monetary value in the marketplace.
Is this why in prison that, because I noticed that when we were giving the percentages, there was a low percentage of black men who were being identified as male escorts, and yet in prison where there is a very large black population, there's a lot of sex going on, and it's my understanding, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that if you're a top guy, you're not gay, okay? It's the one who's receiving who's gay, and you're just penetrating. You're still the man.
Well, different people have different, they define their sexualities in different ways. Sex between men includes a whole range of activities on the sexual menu. But a top person is one that will probably enact more of the hyper-masculine type, and that is he's the person being pleased.
In terms of the
proportion, like in that study, 22% were black. That's a significant number I'm not sure what the percentage of the black population is in the general population, but 22% in that sample is a significant number. You raise a very interesting question around tops and the ethnicity of the escorts. So we did in the 2010 study, which included a sample of 1,200 male escorts in 9 American cities and then 2 European cities. We tried to get a better sense of what was going on in terms of the marketplace, and there's really been also some very interesting work in the U.S. done on that issue that if you want I'll provide some information, and then it may or may not answer your question. But in the 2010 study, more than 50% identified as gay. But 40% identified as bisexual, and about 6.4% identified as straight men or straight self-identifying men. Now, Caucasians were 2.8 times more likely to self-identify as gay to clients, and blacks were 2.7 times more likely to self-identify as bisexual. There was a preference for top positions to be significantly higher in self-identified bisexual and straight male sex workers. Your notion that there is a connection between their sexual positioning and their sexual identity is supported in that.
Is society changing or is evolution changing? Have men always, is there a genetic component to sex, which I believe sexual identity is more genetically oriented? If you're born gay, you're gay. You're born straight, you're straight, and some people are born actually with the ability to be comfortable with both sexes. But is it the permissiveness of society, or is it simply the fact that this was always the way it was genetically, but some societies, based upon religion, based upon whoever was in control, the societies were more permissive, and therefore things were more in the open?
Well, different scholars take different positions on that.
I want to know what you think.
I think it's a complex question, and if you look at it historically, we know that in Greek and Roman societies, those societies were much more accepting of sex between men, and in fact, the records indicate that there were just as many male sex workers as there were as female sex workers in those society. So was our biology very different in Greek and Roman times that we were producing more gay kids? I don't know. We also know our prime minister here in Australia made a very interesting comment recently, which I think highlights your question. He's from the conservative side of politics, and right now in Australia, like also in the U.S., there's this debate about gay marriage. You know, do we legislate for it, and do we support it, or don't we? And there's a popular vote is if people want to marry, let them marry, and of course also in the States, there's quite a lot of a number of your states have done polls, and they found that public support for this issue. Anyways, he was asked, what's his position on this, given the recent polling?
And he said,
and he made the comment. He made a very interesting comment. The comment was something along the lines, "Well, you know, now that there are more gay people in families, maybe we need to change our attitudes." Now, that's an interesting comment because what he was saying is, well, now that the human race has changed and we're biologically producing more gay people, maybe we need to change our values. I don't think that that's why I don't think that that explains why society is changing their values. I think what we're seeing is greater, not only acceptance, but the younger generation have a very different notion of sexuality. It's not black and white. And I think their experiences is also very different. And that's because we're allowing that to occur. We're allowing that to occur in a number of matters. One is, if you look at popular culture and the representation in films or TV series about, in this case, about male escorts or about sexuality and gender, the Borgias, that very popular series about the Pope during the Renaissance period in Italy that was widely watched by audiences across the world. Well, in that, the brothels, the representation of brothels was that services were offered from both male and female escorts to their patrons. There's a French movie called Mauvais Pas that was by Michel Blanc. It was a story about a French man who, a normal middle-class man, hardworking business guy, unintentionally becomes a male escort in London for women, and how that happened. Then there's the HBO series of Game of Thrones. And again, we see the presence of not only male, but also not only a female, but also male escorts offered to
women. Which leads me to an interesting question. If two of the most powerful historical societies, Rome and Greece, who at different times, Rome particularly, was the center of the universe, and Greece was the center of culture and also quite powerful militarily. What is the explanation for there being so many countries that not only punish any type of homosexuality to the point where people would be put to death, but there is no acceptance that it even exists? I mean, how do we get from one extreme to another? Do we blame it just on the religious factor, or are there other factors?
Well, what happened between Greece and Rome in the modern times was that Christianity's condemnation of any type of creative sexual intercourse, not just gay, but any type of, brought about the outlawing of homosexuality in the Western Empire, and consequently male prostitution going underground and being less visible in public discourses. Now, this doesn't mean that there wasn't male prostitution, because street-based male sex work was not an unusual phenomena to see in European cities in the medieval times. But it was highly stigmatized, it was feared, it was punished. In recent times, I think that's been challenged for a number of reasons. And so, technology is also playing a very important role. It's opened up options for the marketing of male sex work, but also it's facilitated and made it much more visible and accessible to male sexualized body to be used as a commodity. And in fact, if you look at in the United States, the online male escort business, what happens is that it's the online activity where people, the escorts, pay a fee to a webmaster to provide their services. The escort has a lot of control over the content. Of course, there are certain rules, and advertises their services, and clients, the public, looks at it, and if they and that means males and females look at it, and if they feel that this is something that it's a commodity that they want to purchase, they purchase it. I think the game has changed.
Do you think that there is a tension and between fundamentalism, whether it be Christian fundamentalism or Islamic fundamentalism or any fundamentalism, that tries to constrict sex to possibly simply marriage, and the punishment of homosexuals or those who have sex outside of marriage to the point of death? Do you think that there's going to be a divided conflict that is able to magnify itself to a point of, of danger?
Well, I mean, I think the answer is obviously that's the case. In the book that we put together, we were trying to locate an expert from the Middle East to write on this topic. It was very difficult to do so. To find such researchers, or two, to find someone that was willing to write such a piece, and then probably be subjected to threats or punishment from their country. So that's not just about an attitude towards sex between men. It's also an attitude towards how women define themselves and express their sexuality. It's a very masculine dominated society with very strict rules. Now, is that normal? Is that the way it should be? Or does that reflect the natural expression of sexualities that human beings are predisposed? If you remove, all of those threats, the threats of being killed, of being put in jail, of punishment, of being disgraced. A lot of people think that if you remove those barriers that are socially imposed, that there is a much more fluid expression.
And I would definitely agree completely, Victor, with that statement. And that's why I see the danger in extreme fundamentalism, because, in fact, you take away a person's individuality. And when you take away their individuality of expression, then you're going to get a lot of people who are not able to act out of their individuality, and that's where tension builds up. But question, we all see very often on TV stories about abuse of children being kidnapped, sold into sex slavery, and so on and so forth. Abuse in the sex industry, which in some countries is extensive, Is it as abusive in the male sex industry as it is in the female sex industry?
That's a really good and valid question to ask, and the answer is it varies globally. So in those countries that have regulated and legalized the sex industry, including the male sex industry, less so for that to occur.
Now, which countries are those, by the way?
So places like the Canada, Scandinavian countries, the UK, to a certain extent, the US, Australia, those countries, it's very male child labor is less likely to be found. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but the male sex industry is mostly built, particularly the male escort industry that work online, where there's quite amount, there's a high amount of accountability, because both the escorts and the clients can easily be identified through exchanges of phone numbers and so forth. But those escorts that take a highly professional view of their services, and those countries that regulate the sex industry, it's much more difficult to occur. Now, but like I said, even in countries like Canada and the U.S. and Australia, poverty always plays a role here, and there's always the possibility of underaged homeless kids, for example, to be exploited in that manner. In countries like in Asia, okay, in Asian countries, Bangladesh, Nepal, what we see is this sex trafficking, and the sex trafficking is both of female and, to a certain extent, but a much lesser extent, males. And then you got to ask yourself the questions. Well, what are the conditions that allow that to occur? So if you bring the sex industry underground, if you don't professionalize it, if you don't value the product that is being sold, if you don't collect taxes, if you don't educate the people who work in the industry. So in terms of, a stereotype, in a study we did here in Australia, that where the sex industry is highly regulated and the government actually develops funds a whole range of programs towards the education of both the public and the escorts who work in the industry, a third of the escorts in Australia hold a higher degree qualification. And about one-third also reported working in the field for more than 3 years as their full-time job. So, I mean, what that's telling us is a lot of these men are highly educated.
Do they pay taxes in Australia and get a pension and stuff like that?
If they have to report their income. And if they report their income, of course, they have to pay taxes. And, of course, if they're in, it's self-employed, and they retire, eventually they're eligible to pay, to receive a pension. But again, that's a value-laden question, in a way. If you accept that the sex industry is an important leisure recreational business, and it plays an important role in society, it's highly professionalized, and you ensure that both clients and workers are protected in terms of a range of health and wellness factors, then that investment is probably justifiable. The sex industry has been here; it's been in our history, from day one. So obviously, there's a it serves a purpose.
Victor, what's sad is if we look at sheer numbers and the number of people on the planet and the countries that we talked about that are open and understand that this is a need and an action and a function that has been going on since time immemorial. We're looking at very few numbers. Northern Europe, Australia, the United States is a large country. But the majority of Latin America, Central America, India, Russia, China, you know, the billions and billions, Indonesia, the billions and billions of people outside of those numbers are strictly opposed to the point where there's punishment and very often that punishment is death. And so what concerns me is you know, the fact that there's what I perceive as more enlightenment, you know, to the extent that they're allowing individuals to find their way around society and not focusing on their personal behavior that's not being destructive to, you know, to anyone, you know, and these societies that where there's an underground sex industry, which is probably in every country, that there, you know, there's probably very harsh treatment.
Well, you know, there is light at the end of the tunnel, because if you go back, you know, 90 years in the U.S. and in Canada and Australia, the attitudes towards homosexuality and the attitudes towards the sex industry, and in particular the male sex industry, was very different. I don't think we would be having this conversation on the radio in the 1920s or in the 1950s.
Maybe the 1920s.
So, you know, even within Western countries, there's been a tremendous shift towards accepting gay issues and gay people and lesbians and the sex industry and particularly with the sex industry and regulating it and coming to terms with the purpose it serves. And that's why, you know, like our book, I mean, if you were to try to find a scientific book on male sex work in society, it's very hard to find one. So, you know, the publishing industry, and in our case, Harrington Park Press and Columbia University Press, produced this book, which is now informing public discussion, informing scholarship, informing a whole range of segments in society about this, and definitely opening up an avenue. I think that will come in the more, less comfortable societies at this point in time that think about homosexuality or gay issues or the sex industry. I think it will change, because the reason why I believe that, and I say that with a fair amount of confidence, is because the evidence indicates that that will happen. But more importantly, it's human nature. We're sexual beings, and I think our sexualities are much more fluid than people who control these things want us to believe. And I think fundamentally, people understand that, and eventually people accept that.
But you know what, Victor, that's coming from a very rational man, okay? I mean, and, you know, when you look at, you know, Islamic fundamentalism or any, you know, any type of fundamentalism that's willing to use violence against, you know, another person's value system, that's not going to change anytime soon. There are two questions that my producer wanted me to ask, and it is kind of interesting to me. He mentioned that there's a disturbing trend in male sex work involving HIV-negative men who are actually seeking HIV-positive partners. Is that actually happening, and could you explain why, if it is?
Okay, so that's a complicated question, because obviously, whether it's in the sex industry or not in the sex industry, there are STIs and HIV. These are sexual health issues that one has to consider, because, you know, through the exchange of fluid you know, there is that risk. And we know that in the population, there is a certain percentage of people who, both in the gay and non-gay population, among males and among women, who are HIV positive. So some of the escorts obviously are negative and some of them are positive, and very much like the makeup of the general population. In the studies in the U.S., particularly in the studies of male escorts, what the facts reveal is that the transmission of HIV through the male sex industry is very low. So, for example, I can't cite American statistics at the moment because I don't have them in my mind, but I do have Australian statistics. The transmission of HIV through the sex industry in Australia is less than 3% in comparison to countries that have a different form of attitude and regulation, like in Asia, where, like, for example, in Nepal or those sorts of countries, where the transmission of HIV through the sex industry is like 60%. So it's very low in our society. It's slightly higher in the United States than it is Australia.
Why are black male sex workers more likely to have HIV than white sex male workers?
Okay. Well, before I answer that one, so that your listener is aware of this, the majority of male escorts, if you go and seek their services, the majority will say that they always practice safe sex. And we found that in our studies, and that's a consistent pattern in studies. Of course, some will say that they don't. That's a minority. So I just want to make sure that's a minority. And often they're pretty upfront, and they negotiate that with their clients in the same way that in the general population, people negotiate safe and unsafe sex. So they find out what their HIV status is, and then they work that out.
If they're sober.
If they're sober, yes. If they're sober and there's no drugs involved, because we do know from studies that the presence of alcohol and hard drugs does influence sexual activities and what happens. Now, what we found there's a really interesting study in the United States by Logan. What he found, and I think that's what your producer probably was pointing out, there were a few things that bisexual and straight sex workers were 3.7 times more likely to practice safer sex, always respectfully, and that male sex workers who were black, gay, and showed an ambiguous sexual intentions were more likely to practice unsafe sex. Why? Well, people have speculated in the gay community and in the black community in the United States, for example, HIV levels are higher than in other communities or other population groups. People are speculating about why that may be so in the general population, and I suppose those arguments also are true in the sex industry, whether it's male or female. But the important point here is that if a society, through its government and health agencies, do the right thing by regulating and providing appropriate education and services, not only to the escorts, but also to the clients, obviously, the transmission of STIs, sexually transmissible infections, and HIV is significantly reduced. Can it be totally eliminated? My personal view there is no, because in the general population, some people are risk takers, despite knowledge of how certain STIs are transmitted, and will do so for whatever their personal motivation to do that is.
How do we protect those who are pedophiles from actually going from a legitimate seeking of expression to have sex, you know, because you have a busy work schedule, whatever the case might be, it doesn't really matter, to actually becoming predators. What kind of protection is there in the enlightened European countries, including our own?
So this is in terms of having access to male escorts who are underaged. Okay, well, if your sex industry is regulated and by governments, no male escorts underage is able to be a male escort and provide their services. So if you look at all of the websites in the United States that are in the public domain and obviously have a form of regulation, none of those escorts are under the age of 18. They can't, if they were, a lot of people would be in serious trouble. It's when the sex industry goes underground that is more likely to occur, and that's what we have to avoid. It's also when the sex industry is not highly professionalized, both on the part of the escorts and the clients, that is likely to occur. So the best solution there is to ensure that an informed society takes the appropriate action so that citizens who want to be the workers or citizens who want to be the clients are able to purchase this commodity within the context of sexual safety, within the context of providing a service that is in the marketplace highly valued and delivered in such a manner that it meets a certain code of practice.
Victor, you've written an incredibly important book. The points that you bring up in terms of the regulation, not only protecting society, but giving society a chance for self-evaluation and self-development is priceless. And I just appreciate, you know, all the work which you've done and your book itself. We're out of time, but thank you so much for the interview. You are a true gentleman.
Thank you, and thank you for giving this topic some space on your program.
It's needed and worth it. Thank you. I want to once again thank Victor for coming onto our show. He got up at 1 in the morning to do it. He's from Australia. Pick up a copy of Victor's book, Male Sex Work and Society. It's on Amazon.com. And also check out his website, VictorMinichiello.com.au. I am Dr. Errol Gluck. Remember, to every problem there is a solution. If there is a problem that's roaming around your head, if there is something that you can't let go of, you could always call our office at 212-599-3195. Keep listening. Keep sending in your feedback. Till next time.